Welcome to the Global Council podcast, where you can hear the GC team discuss and debate topical developments in public policy and regulation from around the world.
Good morning to those in the United States and good afternoon to those in Europe. I'm Aaron Cadell and I lead GC's Washington, D.C. office. I'm pleased to be joined today by my colleagues, Practice Lead Chris Rinkus and Senior Associate Miranda Lutz, all of us in Washington. I wanted to first briefly introduce Chris, as this is the first of our client calls that he has joined. Until January of this year, Chris led policy development and innovation at the U.S. Department of Education, where he worked for several years. Before that, Chris spent nearly 7 years with the Washington, D.C. public school system, where his last role was as budget director. Chris will be a generalist with Global Council, but we're very happy to have his expertise in education policy, an industry that is obviously being transformed due to policy amidst the turmoil of COVID-19. So welcome, Chris. Today, we're going to be discussing the first months of Joe Biden's presidency and taking a look at what's ahead for lawmakers in Congress and the administration. We have in the U.S. Heavy hearts a bit these days, not just because of the continuing challenges of COVID-19, but we've also, as I'm sure everybody has seen in the news, had two mass shootings just in the past couple weeks in Georgia and Colorado, as always seems to plague our country in recent years. And we are starting the trial and the death of George Floyd, which sort of kicked off the Black Lives Matter protests a year ago. So those are happening in the backdrop, but hope springs eternal. We have spring in many parts of the country. Here in DC, our famed cherry blossoms are out. And so we're all hopeful that this coming year will be better than the last has been. So now that the stimulus bill has been passed, Biden and Democrats are eager to move on to other aspects of their agenda, including voting rights, infrastructure, climate change. House Democrats have already passed a number of bills, including HR1, which is a sweeping voting rights bill. And then, in fact, later today, just this afternoon in the U.S. in Pittsburgh, Biden's going to travel up there and that's a critical battleground state, as many know, to unveil his infrastructure bill that could have a price tag on the order of $2.5 trillion. Some details are just emerging about that today, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But both these initiatives are certain to face Republican opposition. So the question is what Biden and the Democrats do in response. So Miranda, let's start with you. How's the Biden administration stood up to Democratic expectations early in the term here? And how would you grade Biden's performance so far?
Sure. So it's a great question. We're now about a little over 2 months into the Biden administration, and both he and Vice President Kamala Harris campaigned on a very progressive and very ambitious agenda. However, they only entered into office with a 50-50 tie in the Senate. So I think that their approach in office so far has to be very realistic as to what they can pass and what they can do, given the congressional arithmetic is a little bit tough right now. So given those dynamics, I think overall the administration has met expectations so far. There was a slate of executive orders early on to undo some of the most impactful Trump deregulation agenda in environment, energy, and certainly in immigration as well. He's also delivered on just the very simple promise to act more presidential and to bring sort of regular order back to the White House. And then I think that the American Rescue Plan, which is the $1.9 trillion COVID stimulus package that passed, is going to be the signature accomplishment of the administration so far, and that has largely met the expectations of Democrats. While it is aimed at COVID recovery, they were able to include some of their other priorities, namely an increase in the amount of the child tax credit, Medicaid reform and expansion, a boost in public school education, which Chris has spoken about and you can read about on our GC website, his blog on that. They weren't able to pass the $15 minimum wage increase, but you can see that they have already checked the box on a number of their campaign promises. So, and just the fact that the ARP, the American Rescue Package, is very popular amongst Americans. It has approval rates as high as 76%, including over half, 52%, that strongly support the bill. So on the whole, that is a pretty good read for the first part of the Biden administration, or the part so far. It's not to say it hasn't been without its challenges. Aaron, you alluded to them. You know, gun control has certainly been raised as an issue again. The crisis at the border has challenged the administration. But I think overall, I'd give them certainly a passing grade, to say the least.
Sure, thanks. And the indications are that the ARP has been popular with Republicans as well, although surely a part of that is the $1,400 direct checks that are being sent to folks below certain income thresholds, and that covers a lot of people. Maybe turning to you, Chris, let's dive into the ARP a little bit, the stimulus bill that was recently passed. What do you think of the bill as you step back, and what does it say about the priorities of the Biden agenda so far?
Thanks, Aaron, and I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for the nice introduction earlier. Looking forward to getting to know everybody on the line and hopefully working together. So the American Rescue Plan was successful really for two reasons. First, it paid off a major presidential campaign promise by President Biden, one that also featured quite prominently in the Senate runoffs in Georgia that ultimately handed control of the Senate to the Democrats. Among other things, the ARP delivered more than $1,400 in direct payments to most Americans. And it really gave President Biden and the Democrats a significant legislative victory within the first 100 days and provided seed money for many, if not most, of their top priorities, including money for vaccine distribution, vaccine COVID testing, and school reopening, among other things. The second reason it was successful is that it really put congressional Republicans in a difficult position. It illustrated that the Republicans lacked a coherent message. They were never able to mount any meaningful opposition to the bill, and in many ways showed that they are somewhat in disarray after the Trump years. It's difficult for them to criticize large spending bills after having abandoned fiscal conservatism to a large degree during the past 4 years. In general, the popularity of the bill, the fact that it came packaged as COVID relief, when, as many of its critics would claim, the spending was not exclusively COVID related, ultimately made it very hard to mount any sort of meaningful criticism. And although it passed on a strict party line vote, it remains very popular, and polls consistently show that most Americans are supportive of it. I think long-term, the risk with the ARP is the same risk that we'll discuss with some other upcoming legislative efforts, which is the threat of inflation and the question as to how the markets will react to these high price tag spending bills. Although the Fed Chairman Jay Powell and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen have both discussed at length the need for economic stimulus to help combat unemployment, which remains high, and to get the economy back to its pre-COVID levels, there are concerns, credible concerns, that some of the spending could increase inflation, which would have implications on interest rates and other economic issues.
Yeah, certainly. And I think we're many people are watching, not just market participants, are watching the move up in the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield below 1% to end last year. And I think at last check, it's at 1.7. So still low by historical standards, but a pretty big move up. And that's affected the equity markets here in the U.S., particularly tech stocks and so forth. Sticking with you, Chris, what do Democrats and Biden turn to next now that the ARP is in the books?
Thanks, Aaron. Well, I'm glad you asked, because there's actually, you mentioned, you know, breaking news this morning. The president's infrastructure plan was released from embargo early this morning. He's planning to formally announce it during a speech in Pittsburgh, but many of the details have already come out. And so I'd love to describe it a little bit. What it looks like is the Biden administration will take a broad view of infrastructure and split it into two parts. So a traditional infrastructure package, and then a second, more social welfare-oriented package to come later. And today, he will spend most of his time describing the traditional infrastructure package. It's expected to be about $2.5 trillion over the next 8 years. That would be larger than the American Rescue Plan. I would hazard to guess that it would be one of the largest spending bills in American history. And the president will also propose increases in the corporate tax rate and some other tax adjustments over the next 15 years to cover the cost. Although it's intended to be an infrastructure bill, it looks as if today they will largely package it as a jobs bill, which I think is an interesting approach, likely to be appealing. You know, the U.S. is still experiencing higher unemployment than it did pre-pandemic. And many of these spending programs, including the plan, should have a positive effect on job creation. It's been reported that Speaker Pelosi wants to try to pass it by early July, which would be a very aggressive timetable. Unlike the American Rescue Plan, which was based on previously written legislation, the HEROES Act, Democrats will need to write this plan effectively from scratch and only have about 6 working weeks to do it. And then ultimately passage of infrastructure will almost certainly have to be done through reconciliation, although the administration and congressional Democrats continue to suggest they want to try bipartisanship. Just one or two other quick points here. So some of the top line numbers for the traditional infrastructure package include over $600 billion for transportation, with nearly $175 billion going to the electric vehicle market, over $100 billion for safe drinking water, $100 billion for high-speed broadband, $100 billion for U.S. power grid, over $100 billion for public schools and institutions of higher education, and another $100 billion for workforce development. So really, this is a laundry list of progressive priorities. And should it pass, taking this together with the American Rescue Plan, you're talking about an unprecedented investment in historically progressive plans. And so I think if this should come to pass, you know, even though we're still talking about year one of the Biden presidency, he's making a mark that will last far beyond his first term.
Yeah, there's an old saying in DC, a billion here, a billion there, talking about real money. We've got to update that, 100 billion here, 100 billion there, and you're talking about real money. I think it also strikes me that it's the U.S., although we hate to admit it, heading sort of in the direction of Europe, of greater social safety net and involvement of the government in daily life, which is where we're all heading with COVID and with potentially higher taxes. Miranda, back to you. You've worked on Capitol Hill. You've been through the wars on this. What areas, if any, exist where Democrats and Republicans can really cooperate, as opposed to the kind of nods to bipartisanship which we're hearing so far? And I'm also just interested in your thought on that kind of January timeframe and what Pelosi maybe is really saying in terms of timing for this infrastructure bill.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a tough road for bipartisanship. Although that was a big campaign promise for Biden and Harris, I think it's going to be probably the toughest one for them to deliver on. The incentives for bipartisanship right now are just extremely low. Democrats, I think, will make a show of trying to work with Republicans on the traditional infrastructure package, roads, highways, bridges. You know, everyone has something in their district that could be fixed. So ostensibly, there should be room for bipartisanship there. But I am very skeptical that this will be a successful endeavor, largely because when you bring in tax policy and try to fund infrastructure via increased taxes, you lose Republicans right after the bat. I worked on the Hill through the passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and that was a little bit scarring, to say the least. But tax policy is extremely difficult. It's going to be a party line vote. And I think that you'll largely continue this bifurcation of policy, where we see it's just going to be the Democrats' roadshow for the next year or so. And that's largely driven by the need for them to deliver ahead of midterms. The midterm race is coming up really quick, and their tight margins in the Senate. Democrats did not win as many seats in the House as they expected, so they are potentially at risk of losing control of the House as well. And so they will want to make some impact ahead of that. so that they can campaign on those reforms that they've done. And then
maybe just a question on timing, and particularly when you get into taxes, we've already gotten some questions from clients about whether tax increases could be retroactive. Just walk us through that sort of from July through till the end of the year kind of time frame, and how Congress will negotiate those deadlines.
Sure. So July is a very ambitious timeline. You usually see these types of massive spending bills come out in the fall, or that's when they get passed. So you're looking at a September, October timeline, and there will be debates throughout the summer on those issues as to whether or not the taxes will be retroactive. You know, how much are you going to change? If you're going to incorporate SALT deductions, all of that will be fleshed out in the coming months. And I think right now, the approach for Democrats is to draw some lines in the sand, but not too many, so that they can work on fleshing this out. And they're going to be passing this infrastructure package through budget reconciliation. So there are limits. You're not allowed to increase the U.S. debt beyond 10 years. And so that's where these tax measures come in. And so they'll be playing with CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, which determines, you know, how much these bills are going to cost. And that's where they'll determine how to tweak these numbers. So the timeline you're looking at for this actually being, passed is going to be later this year in the fall, ahead, like right before 2022.
Got it. As our budget reconciliation expert, can you also just remind us about the Byrd rule? And there's some talk about, we'll get into the filibuster in a second, but just before we get there, just to level set, just remind us of what the Byrd rule and the Senate parliamentarian, sort of a 19th century relic of some ways, that's very important right now.
Becoming the most important person in Washington, D.C.
The rules around that.
So budget reconciliation can really only pertain to legislation that is either revenue generating, so taxes, or that affects the federal budget spending. And so it's very hard to change actual policy through this mechanism. So the way that you can get around this is tying all of the policy objectives that you want to make to some sort of fiscal or monetary impact, tax incentive, spending cuts, spending increases. But there is a very powerful person in the Senate, and it is the Senate parliamentarian. And under the Byrd rule, that parliamentarian can determine whether or not a provision in the budget reconciliation bill is actually germane to the federal budget. So they have kind of this very broad power to say what can and cannot be in the bill. And it's very hard to navigate that because it's just one person. There is some precedent that lawmakers and staffers can build off of to figure out what will be allowed to be included. But it really is, they'll kind of throw everything against the wall, and the Senate parliamentarian will determine what sticks. So there's another element of budget reconciliation, is that you can only do it once per fiscal year. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is working, potentially working some Senate maneuvers to try and allow them to use this mechanism more than once per fiscal year, which has not been done before. That's still being worked out. We'll see. I think it's far more likely that they'll get one more crack at this year for fiscal year 2022. And then potentially they could use budget reconciliation again in 22 for fiscal year 2023. It's an exciting time. Certainly if you're the Senate parliamentarian, I'm sure that is a very stressful job right now.
Yeah. I think it's another reason why Pelosi's probably just putting July out there to kick it, to get people up and running with hopes of getting something done in the fall, because you'd have to keep options open to do reconciliation again. And the government's exactly. Just starting until October. So, all right, well, let's shift to the filibuster, another vestige of a time gone by that has become critically important. Discussion around, is it a way to allow the Democrats to achieve the ambitious agenda on which Biden campaigned, but a hot button issue and has been for many decades. So what do you think is going to happen to the filibuster? Is it reformed? Does it remain the same? And give us some sense of the current state of play with the discussions among the Democrats about it.
Yeah, that is not an easy question right now, but a very important one. I think that there is growing frustration. Largely since Republicans replaced Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court, that the Democratic response will be to eliminate the filibuster. That's tough to balance when you have key institutionalists such as President Biden in the White House, who traditionally had been reticent to eliminate this filibuster. We saw in a press conference last week that he basically opened the door to make changes to the filibuster. And you have other moderate voices like Amy Klobuchar and Dick Durbin, senators of Minnesota and Illinois, respectively, that have also voiced their concerns that the filibuster will basically hamstring Democrats and make it impossible for them to pass legislation on other key Democratic priorities outside of infrastructure and jobs, namely voting rights, racial equality, gun control. And as you alluded to at the beginning of the call, Aaron, the recent shootings in Atlanta, Georgia, and Boulder, Colorado have really reignited the gun control debate. So far, we've seen President Biden has very much stuck to his script of, we got the ARP passed, now we're doing infrastructure, and he's not really being deterred from that that agenda, which I think is important to note, because if you are going to eliminate the filibuster, or if Democrats are going to eliminate the filibuster, it's not likely going to happen in the short term, and I mean short term in like the next 6 to 8 months, because of the focus on infrastructure and because there is a pathway for Democrats to pass that infrastructure package, that jobs package, through budget reconciliation. Traditionally, the majority party loses 26 seats in the first midterm election. And so that is going to be a very tough reality for Democrats if that holds true. And so they will be looking to kind of campaign on successes through the infrastructure package, but then use perhaps voting rights and racial equality legislation as the foundation for why more Democrats should be elected in 2022. So if I'm putting on my Democratic hat, that's what I think that they're thinking, and that's certainly what we're hearing. If I'm switching back to the Republican side, they have issued some really scorching rebukes and saying that if you eliminate the filibuster, this will come back to bite you. Republicans will do the same thing that Democrats are doing and pass extremely conservative legislation. And you are setting up this potential swinging trend in policy where if the filibuster is gone, every 4 years, every 2 years, you could get massive shifts in U.S. policy, which is traditionally quite slow to react, for better or worse. And so that would make a pretty sizable impact on the policy landscape in D.C. In terms of the filibuster debate, there are two names that are probably the most important. It's Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. And they have been the obstacles to filibuster elimination so far. It's almost in their personal interest to keep the filibuster in place, because then they remain as the two most important people and on Capitol Hill determining what Democrats.
Except for the Senate parliamentarian.
Except for the Senate parliamentarian, yes, another very important role. But they have a far greater influence over the direction of Democratic legislation with the filibuster in place. I think that line gets harder to hold if you have, unfortunately, more mass shootings, or if you have more protests for, racial equality, and the outcome of the case against Derek Chauvin will certainly be potentially could be one of those guideposts for how this plays out. So I guess that is to say that, barring certain major events that could trigger a lot of pressure on Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, I think for the rest of the year, they'll hold the line on filibuster. If Democrats can see a pathway for eliminating the filibuster to potentially help them in 2022, they could do that later this year. But given that it's a tight timeline, even to just get infrastructure package through. So if you're just looking at time constraints, you know, they can easily keep this conversation on the filibuster and other Democratic priorities, you know, in the zeitgeist while making actual progress on infrastructure.
Yeah, it does feel like Biden is, he realizes that it would be crossing a major Rubicon that would be hard. You know, you couldn't go back. And I think by his, you know, major speech today in Pittsburgh, he's clearly saying, look, let's pick this infrastructure, this Build Back Better plan, and a big part of his campaign focused on that. I want to be respectful of folks' time, and maybe in the remaining couple of minutes we have before the top of the hour, just want to turn back to you, Chris, to I think it's a good window into a given industry that's being affected by all this massive spending, as we said, you know, trillions of dollars being spent, more than $100 billion, that maybe close to $200 billion of that is going to the public schools, K-12 public schools in the U.S., which is a huge number. Obviously, folks can read your note or follow up with you to talk about it. But can you just kind of hit the highlights of the AARP's impact on public schools in the U.S. and where you think some of that money will end up in the next year or next couple of years?
Sure. Thanks, Aaron. I agree. I think K-12 schools is an interesting lens by which to view the larger packages, because you're right. K-12 public schools in the United States received over $120 billion in the AARP on top of another 65 to 70 billion that they received last year in stimulus packages. And so altogether, you've got nearly 200 billion. That's just an unprecedented amount of federal money in the system in a very short period of time. You know, when we analyze the numbers, there's multiple ways to look at it, but you know, it's upwards of $4,000 per student. It's, you know, nearly 10 times what the federal government spends in an average year. And when you start to break it up by state, I mean, you're looking at, you know, more than $1 billion on average for each state in the US. And so, you know, really the message has been this changes the landscape for K-12 education for the foreseeable future. The Congressional Budget Office estimates the spending will happen for the most part over the next 3 years. And these school districts are going to be better positioned as buyers than they've really ever been in the past. And I think you will see this across a number of areas. You know, in many ways, the most effective criticism of the AARP has been its spending is not strictly COVID related. I think you see this here and elsewhere. Many of the most dire predictions from an economic standpoint didn't materialize. State and local revenues, for example, which fund many state and local services, didn't decline to the extent that was once predicted. And so you not only have a huge infusion of cash, you also have economic conditions that aren't as bad as once thought. And altogether, you know, really could prime some of these industries for a very quick and strong rebound in the later part of this year.
Thanks, Chris. Well, let's wrap it up there. Thank you all for joining. Thank you, Miranda and Chris. We'll mention one other event that we have coming up. We will continue to do these calls just with the GC USA team here in Washington every few weeks as all the things that we talked about play out over the rest of this year. Folks should keep an eye out for a call with Nick Mulvaney, the former chief of staff and budget director for President Trump, also head of the CFPB for a time during the Trump administration, about his reflections on serving in the administration, his thoughts on the current moment and the start that Biden has made, and how the Republican Party will evolve. Clearly, that's another part of the story we didn't get into too much in this call, but is critically important. Sort of the pro-Trump and anti-Trump wings of the party sort of fighting it out. So that should be on or about April 19th or 20th. So look out for that. So thanks all again. We'll talk to you soon. So have a great rest of your day. Thank you.
For more insights, blogs, and analysis, you can visit our website, www.global-council.com, and subscribe to our mailing list. And you can follow us on Twitter at global_council.